Hello, I'm Maria Zylstra with For Lingua Franca on ABC Radio National, as well as on the VooVooVoo, the very teacherly Ursula Dubosarski, famed for her children's fiction, but who's now published her second book of non-fiction for kids on language, called The Return of the Word Spy, and which, like the original Word Spy that was featured here on Lingua Franca a couple of years ago, is illustrated by the more masterly than ever Toby Riddle. Now, when I spoke to Ursula in 2008 about the first Word Spy, we nodded respectfully in the direction of the New South Wales School magazine, where the Word Spy actually had its first incarnation as a column. And as it turns out, its personality springs from there too. So here she is again to discuss the return of the Word Spy, which has a really cosy, kids' clubby atmosphere. Ursula Dubosarski.
Look, I'm glad that it feels that way to you, and I think that style is distinctive and also probably unusual for non-fiction, or, you know, probably both adults and children's non-fiction. And I think the way it happened was the origins of the book, as I probably told you last time, began as a column in a magazine, the New South Wales School magazine. And so the kind of tradition of the magazine in those sorts of short columns was to, you know, to write in the second person, I suppose, you know, to speak directly to the children as if you were a character. That was just a kind of, you know, magazine tradition, and I guess I picked up on it while I was there. And I think I was talking about this with Toby only today. I think, for example, if, you know, Toby and I had been given an assignment, you know, do a book together, you know, about English language for children, it wouldn't have turned out like this. You know, this in a way happened. Part of it, a lot of its character is comes from its sort of natural kind of origins.
Yeah, yeah.
That it developed on its own, and then it sort of turned into a book. And I think that the character and the voice is all part of that. Because often, obviously, with nonfiction, you know, there's a tendency to have a very objective voice, I suppose, that it's sort of scientific, even, you know, even if it's not, the idea is you have this scientific language and it's all meant to sound very objective, whereas this is, I guess, mixing the you know, the fictional kind of traditions with non-fiction.
Right. Well, it's more the mood, I think, that struck me. The feeling of it, you feel like you're sitting on the couch with someone while they're yabbing on to you and telling you something rather than teaching you something.
Yes, rather than being instructed. That's right. That's right. And look, I suppose when writing it, I was all the time, and this also comes from the magazine, I suppose, that while you're writing it, you're almost visualising a group of children in front of you, and you're imagining the questions they're going to ask you as you say something. So it really is almost like a conversation. So I guess you're putting yourself in the mind of a curious child. You know, it doesn't have to be an egghead or highly intelligent child, but just a naturally curious child. And you say something and you suddenly think, well, you know, if I was a child and somebody said that to me, this is what I would wonder. And that's sort of how it continued.
What educational level is it pitched at? Upper primary?
Yeah, I guess it's upper primary, lower secondary is, I think, probably. Look, I think it's the kind of book that, you know, if you're interested in language, can be obviously enjoyed by any age. But in terms of that kind of, as you say, that sort of jolly, clubby sort of atmosphere, I think it is aimed at essentially, I suppose, maybe 10 to 14, something like that.
Mm. Well, in its very upbeat way, you describe grammar as, and I'm quoting here, like a magic toy box. It's quite an unusual way to describe grammar.
And, oh, well.
and then you go on.
I was not a bit try hard, that's right.
Well, and then you go on to describe the workings of that toy box as if it's a play in which there are many actors. And there's a great illustration of Toby's with
fabulous?
All the individual words of a sentence lined up like characters across a stage, saying their words one by one in speech balloons and wearing T-shirts that label what kind of work that word does. It's a fantastic image. I love it.
It is fantastic, isn't it? And it's interesting that I tend to, you know, when I'm trying to explain something, I have a tendency to use metaphor. And it's interesting that Toby has noticed that a lot of my metaphors tend to be visual, although I'm always telling myself I'm not a visual person. And he's been fantastic at picking up on those metaphors and actually, you know, making them visual. And I think that one of the actors on a stage, he's done really beautifully. And I suppose what I wanted to get across there was, you know, rather than this sense of sort of rigid categories where, you know, these sort of words on a page and this is the sort of rule about it, I wanted to get that sense of dynamism and energy and mischievousness, mischief, that the characters might sort of push each other over or try and take each other's parts, and that a sentence is a very, you know, dynamic and fluid kind of thing, that it's not a sort of, it's not a whole lot of, you know, statues on the stage, that there's something sort of live about each of those words and anything can happen. I guess that sense that, you know, of a slightly chaotic kind of dramatic performance, like theatre sports or something where you feel anything could happen. That was the kind of feeling I wanted to convey about a sentence rather than something that gets a ticker across.
Yeah, well, and as in the words by the original book, the first one, which I seem to recall describing as a great do book. These words are once again doing stuff. You describe the kind of work that they do. And after defining nouns and adjectives, you go on to discuss articles, pointing out that their name derives from the Latinate articulus, meaning little joint. And that's a nice fact. And then you talk about verbs and adverbs, conjunctions and interjections, prepositions and pronouns. And then you move on to sentence construction and word order. It really is a serious educational project.
Yeah, it is. And I suppose that was a feeling that I really wanted to include a kind of discussion of that kind of, I suppose, these sort of traditional basic categories of grammar in the book. I guess partly in, you know, it's partly in response, really, to the response to the first book, The Word Spy, particularly from teachers who would say to me, oh, you're going to do something about grammar in another book. And it seemed to be this recurrent anxiety. And I guess grammar is one of those sort of words that make people anxious. It's certainly, you know, coming up a lot in the papers lately with all the discussion about the national curriculum and so on. And, you know, the English curriculum is going to contain grammar. And whatever is meant by grammar in that context, I'm really not quite sure. But there's just a general sort of feeling of anxiety about should we learn grammar or why doesn't anyone learn grammar and that kind of thing. So I suppose I just felt a kind of this sort of feeling that somehow grammar was either sort of boring or punishing or irrelevant, whereas, you know, or it was absolutely vital to, you know, education. I guess just all those kinds of anxieties come up. And it seemed to me that it would just be a really kind of useful and useful is a very dry word. I'm not really into being useful sometimes. It just seemed an opportunity, I suppose, within the context, because my background is not linguistic. It's, you know, such as my academic background is, it's in literature. And I suppose to me that's how I see grammar, through the prism of literature and story and through in the context of use. And I guess that's what I thought, that if I'm talking with excitement and pleasure about how to make stories and how to use words and all of that, and, you know, how to speak and write and read, that was the context in which these sorts of basic concepts about grammar could most profitably be explained to children and indeed to teachers, you know, so that it's not this either sort of forbidding kind of system which you have to learn or else you're marked as ignorant or something like that, or else it's something, you know, to be rejected along with a whole lot of other, you know, traditional types of knowledge that, you know, are thought to belong to the past. So I guess, you know, demystifying sounds a bit, you know, a bit trendy, and it's not really about demystifying because grammar is extremely mysterious. And it's certainly, I suppose that's what I was trying to convey in some of those metaphors about the magic box or the deep secret caves where you're waving your torch around and trying to work out how language works. Yeah.
Well, I think it must be a long-standing interest of yours. I'm convinced that it must be a long-standing interest of yours because you include a reference to how, when you were a school child yourself, you made a list, you collected obsolete words that you'd put into your stories. So you were always a word spy.
Yes, perhaps I was just being difficult, I'm not sure. But look, I think there is a certain age at which sort of word-oriented children, this would have been about the age of 10, just get terribly excited by, you know, all the words out there, and they want to put the most unusual words inside their stories. I think all teachers would have children in their classes like that, that produce these possibly quite incomprehensible stories just full of, you know, the longest, strangest words they can find. And yes, my period of the obsolete words, I mean, I knew what they meant because I learned the meaning of them. But so, you know, anything to do with words, I just seemed to me, you know, tremendously interesting and just constantly open doors, I suppose.
Mm. Well, that fascination really comes through, and I really liked your inclusion too of silent languages, as well as your reference to the deaf community on Martha's Vineyard, the island off New England on the east coast of the USA.
Look, that's a fascinating piece of history, I suppose, isn't it? This virtually bilingual island where the population of deaf people to non-deaf people was, I'm not exactly sure what the proportion was, but certainly well above the average.
I think it was about a quarter.
About a quarter. It's
yes,
extraordinary, isn't
much
it?
Much more than the average. It was significant enough that the hearing population also learned to sign. And I think every family had a deaf member, so it was,
so it was a
really
very
case of necessity. Yeah.
Thing. And it's fascinating. There's a very lovely book about it that I found somewhere which had quite a verbatim kind of oral history kind of memories of old people that remembering back, because this is, you know, going back to the 19th century.
And earlier.
And their descriptions of that very easy, it makes you, you know, and obviously for them that was the natural way to live. It wasn't this sort of contrived thing that we have to learn another language. You know, it was just it makes you feel, as indeed I guess is true, that it's much more normal to be bilingual than it is to be monolingual. But I think, you know, English speakers, we tend to forget that. That, you know, there are more people, more children in the world speak more than one language than only speak one. I guess we tend to think
We think we're the norm here
and that
in
terribly challenging to learn another language.
Well, finally, right at the end in the book, you touch on what you call one of the most astonishing marvels of all, the magical world of writing, and you give a very short rendition of writing technology over time.
Yes, it is short. It's sort of the fourth and final part of the book. And, of course, because obviously when you start to write a language, it's a different thing altogether and things happen to the language. And also it's very, the way you write it depends on the technology that is available at the time and how does that affect how we think and all of that. And these are very, very big topics. I suppose we sort of tend to think that our language is sort of somehow almost separated from the way we use it, if that makes sense, if you know what I mean, or separated from the technology. But I guess it's just incredibly bound up with it as well.
Ursula Dubosarski, tuning kids into the magic of language and even grammar. And clearly no sucker for that lazy old line about how hard languages are. She's the author, with Toby Riddle as the illustrator, of The Return of the Word Spy, just out from Penguin Australia. From me, Maria Zylstra. Ciao, ciao.